This is the Alaskan Legislative Review, a program of analysis and discussion of issues facing the Alaska State Legislature with faculty and staff from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. I'm your host, Scott Sterling. Tonight we will focus on state loan programs. Our guest is Monica Thomas, Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Thank you for being on the show, Monica.
Glad to be here, Scott.
I'd like to start off the program by talking about the scope of state loan programs, because it's pretty apparent to most of us that the state of Alaska is in the business of loaning quite a bit of money to different people and organizations, and the amount of money is quite large. Could you tell us how many different state loan programs are there?
Well, to date it appears that there are approximately 40, but since not all of them are funded, approximately three-quarters of them are funded, not all, however, to the appropriation levels that were guaranteed. I would say that probably there are 25 to 30 active loan programs in the state.
Could you tell us what kind of loan programs go where? For example, are loans concentrated in any one area, such as small business or fishing?
Clearly, loan programs are concentrated in the area of housing. Through FY83 funding, which is the fiscal year in which we're in now, approximately one-half of the total dollar value of all loan funds are in housing. That estimate is approximately $1.5 billion.
So housing takes up the most of it, and the rest are spread across what?
Approximately one-fourth go to economic development projects. These can be everything from mining loans, to fishing loans, to agricultural loans. These can go to small business loans. And the other approximate one-quarter go to social programs, the largest block of those being, of course, the student loan program.
What's the purpose of so many state loan programs? Are they necessary because of lack of private capital in the state?
Well, of course, as an economist, I would like to believe that we have so many state loan programs because there are economic rationales for such loan programs. I think we have to be honest and realize, however, that many of them are political. For example, the student loan program. We have to ask ourselves, what's the purpose of a program like the state loan program for students? Has it gone in the directions we've wanted it to go, or is it cross odds? I think it's interesting to note that the vast majority of the state loan programs and the vast majority of the money for state loan programs has grown along with the increase in petroleum revenues. And without the petroleum revenues, we did not have state loan programs, although we had some on the books, particularly for veterans, and the student loan program is an old one. But the amount of money has grown enormously since 1978 as a result of the increase in petroleum revenues. So we have to ask ourselves then, are state loan programs a function of petroleum revenues, or are they a function of real economic needs in the state? There is a lack of capital in the state. By capital, I don't like to use the word, economists use capital to mean things like machines. But if we're talking about capital in terms of money, there is a lack of private funds in the state. For example, the largest bank in California is far larger than all of the sum totals of all the private funds in the state of Alaska. So our banks are incapable of making the kinds of loans necessary for large-scale economic development in the state. They also are not capable of funding all of the needs of students in the state, because we're talking about banks that have a very small population base, 400,000 people. After all, that's much smaller than the city of Seattle. So we couldn't expect our private institutions to have that kind of capital.
There's been some comment over the past year or so about the state's banking industry being opened up to banks coming from outside and the larger banking corporations coming into the state. Presumably that would help bring more private money into the state available for loans. Do you think as petroleum revenues decline that it might be conducive for our economy to have these larger corporations move in and maybe replace some of the money that the state now loans?
If the belief that petroleum revenues are going to decline is in fact a reality, and of course that depends on who you talk with, it's clear that petroleum revenues in FY83 are down from FY82, and the petroleum revenues for next year will be down from this year, and it appears in FY85 they'll be down from FY84. Clearly, Prudhoe Bay peaks in 87 or 88, depending on who you talk to. And unless the value of oil rises immeasurably in the late 1980s, then clearly we're going to have a decline in petroleum revenues. Now, if we have a decline in petroleum revenues, and if you believe that what drives the economy of the state of Alaska is petroleum revenues, then if I were a private banking institution outside of Alaska, I would not want to come into Alaska in the late 1980s and 1990s because I wouldn't see it as a growing, prospering, expanding area. However, if another Prudhoe Bay is found, or if the Beaufort Sea comes in, or if the price of oil rises immeasurably, or a lot of combinations of ores, then it might be a very good move. It's interesting that when that the opportunity first arose, there was a lot of talk that the banking institutions were going to, you know, rush into the state. And to date, I only know of one merger with a bank within the state, which is a small bank, or with an out-of-state banking corporation. So we have not had the large mergers that everyone thought was going to happen. You know, all of our banks were going to disappear into the large corporations. It hasn't happened to date. Of course, it's been a recessed economy in the Pacific Northwest, and so banking institutions in the Pacific Northwest are not in a position for expansion right now. They're in a position of sitting and waiting.
So we see that loan programs at the level we now experience are really a function of our petroleum revenues. Is it a case where we've created a need where one didn't exist before when we started creating these programs?
Well, one of the things you have to ask is, what are you going to do with your petroleum revenue? We tried one thing this year. That was called the Permanent Fund Dividend Program. And depending upon what income category you were in, anywhere from 21 to 38% of your $1,000 went outside to Uncle Sam in the form of federal income tax. Clearly, that's a drain on the petroleum revenues which are received by the state of Alaska. The state has consistently struggled with, how do you get the benefits of petroleum revenues to the people of the state without draining those revenues out of the state in the form of income tax? If you give it to people, clearly Uncle Sam will be there ready to tax it. However, if you give it to them in terms of subsidized loans, to date, the IRS has not decided that the difference between a subsidized loan and a market value loan is taxable income. And so to that extent, loan programs have kept money inside the state and have clearly passed on the benefits of petroleum revenues to people. So from that standpoint alone, that is to say distributing petroleum wealth, it may be a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the cost of state loan programs. What portion of the state budget is devoted to loan programs?
Well, of course, it depends on what year. In our first very, very plus years, we found that there were large appropriations of state loan programs, 78, 79, 80. We take this year, which is FY83, which ends on June 30th of 1983, we have appropriated $316 million to the state loan program. Of that, approximately $150 million going to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation for subsidies for low-interest loans. The rest of them are going to economic development, fishing, agriculture, and mining, and a large block, close to $60 million, is going to the Alaska Student Loan Program. So it appears that the same ratio is holding. About 50% of the appropriation this year is going to housing, and the other 50% is going to social programs and economic development programs.
So housing remains the priority item, the number one priority in the
loan. Oh, clearly. And, of course, what you have to ask yourself is, over the last few years when interest rates have been so high and interest rates on housing programs have been so low, how much money has the state of Alaska lost when they could have gone out and put that money in the money market or something else and receive the high interest rates? Because there's clearly a loss or an opportunity cost in terms of the money they did not receive because they loaned money out at lower rates of interest than they could have received.
Could you explain for the audience how the state borrows money for its housing loan program and what the difference is, how it works, that there is a difference between the interest the state pays to borrow the money and the interest it charges when it loans the money?
Well, clearly from petroleum revenues, they aren't borrowing anything. The money is flowing into the state treasury from Prudhoe Bay. Approximately at the present time, 90% of all state revenues are coming from that small, approximate 500,000-acre plot at Prudhoe Bay, which we were wise enough to select in the statehood allocations in the early 1960s. And so those monies, of course, flow through royalties, through severance taxes, through property taxes, and through the petroleum corporate income tax process into the state treasury. From there, of course, the money sitting there in the state treasury can be appropriated by the legislature in any way they see fit. And as, for example, this year that we're in now, they saw fit to appropriate up to approximately $3 billion, $316 million to the state loan program. Then they go into the loan programs, and if they're revolving loan programs, then one would presume that if people pay back the loan over time, then the money revolve, that is to say, in perpetuity, remain to be loaned out to someone else. And if the money continues to come back in, then one would presume those loan programs can go on forever and ever and ever. As long, of course, as people pay back as much as is taken out. And one of the problems, of course, we've had in the student loan program in the past is that we've had a high rate of forfeiture in the early years because the state never went after the people who never paid. Presumably, they are monitoring that more closely, but only time will tell. There's a great problem if people leave the state.
All right. And now, how about the way the state loans money for housing outside of general fund appropriations?
Okay, well, what they generally do and what they've done with loan programs is they set up either corporations or they set up agencies within the departments of state government which function. For example, there's something called the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund, which is administered by DNR, Department of Natural Resources, and it provides loans to farming operations. And the purpose is clearly to encourage agricultural development across the state. FY83 funding was $10 million. Now, that is administered then as an agency within DNR. Another loan program, of course, is the Alaska Housing Finance, or what is referred to as, and it appropriates money through a revolving loan process. There's, of course, the fishing loan program. The fishing loan program, amongst other things, will allow fishermen to buy limited entry permits. And the purpose of that, of course, is to try to reduce the number of out-of-state people who have limited entry permits by allowing Alaska fishermen only to buy it. And all of these programs, then, are agency programs that presumably go on and on and on. And as the money comes back in from those who pay back, then it goes out to someone else who needs the money.
All right, so we see that the state is in the loan business in a big way.
Yes.
And
there are some clear implications of
that. That necessarily requires that the state be have an administrative structure to manage it and keep track of it. How does the legislature keep track of the loan programs? How does the legislature know what's being loaned out, what kind of return they're getting, that kind of thing?
Well, the legislature requires that each loan program in the early part of the following year, after the completion of a year, must state to the legislature how the money was appropriated, how much went out, how much came in, what the rate of interest, that is to say the subsidized rate of interest on those loans, what the market rate of interest was at that time, what the difference was between the market rate of interest and the subsidized rate of interest, also how much the state lost in a sense or an opportunity cost between what they could have received and what they did receive, and also the income level of the people who received the loans to make sure that there was an equity.
So the difference, there is a difference between the market rate and the state subsidized rate, which...
There was clearly over the last few years. Now, of course, with the prime rate of interest falling yesterday to 10.5%, which is the lowest prime interest rate of the major banks across the country in 4 years, the difference between our subsidized rates of interest and the market rate of interest is clearly closing. But, you know, there have been times over the last several years in which, whereas the market rate of interest for housing loans, mortgage loans, might have been as high as 20-21%. The state was loaning at interest rates of 7-9% less, which was clearly a large difference between the market rate and the subsidized rate. What it did, which may have been good, is it in some ways prevented Alaska from suffering the recessionary times that the rest of the country did, because one of the key portions of an economy is housing and new housing starts. And people just built houses in Alaska like there was no tomorrow because they were able to obtain buyers because buyers saw the rate of interest as the subsidized rate of interest, not the real market rate of interest. So clearly more people bought houses. The state had more houses available. People generated economic activity, which would not have occurred had we not had a subsidized rate. But then we could also say that what we did is we artificially then stimulated the economy, which would not have occurred otherwise.
That's an interesting point. As the market rate and the subsidized rate come closer together, will the state's loan programs continue to be an artificial economic stimulus, or will we reach a point where the state can be loaning money at the same interest rate that you might be able to get it at a bank? Will we continue to see the same level of activity?
Yes, because, of course, there's no reason that the state cannot drop their subsidized rate of interest. As you know, there's a lot of talk about raising the rate of interest to student loan programs. What is it, from 5, I believe, to what, 9%? It's always kind of like you're always just behind the action, because they've talked about that for some time, and it sounds like by the time they finally get around to it, if the economy continues to strengthen without inflation, the real market rate of interest may come down at the time we're finally trying to catch up.
So we could see a case where the market rate might come below with a state subsidized rate?
Well, I don't know that it would come below, but by the time we adjust for what happened 2 years ago, we'll already be past 2 years ago and into a new level. So it's kind of interesting. And that, in part, is a political process, because one does not make those decisions instantly, whereas banks make those decisions instantly as a private corporation.
It's interesting. Would any bank deem it worthwhile to loan money to students at a given interest rate, as long as the state program's in existence?
Of course, you're putting me on the spot as to whether I think students are reliable as far as... No, I don't think that probably it'd be a real good investment, because for one thing, what kind of collateral are you going to put up on students? Their future earnings? One of the things with many of these, you see, is for the housing programs, you can put up mortgage. For the fishing programs, you can put up limited entry permits. For the agricultural programs, you can put up title to the land. For small business, you can put up the title to the business. With student loans, what are you going to put up as collateral? So I think traditionally government has been in the student loan program. It has not, however, traditionally been state government. It's been traditionally been the federal government, because commonly the private sector does not loan money to students because of the lack of collateral.
I would like to go back to the housing loan business for a minute and ask you, what's the worst case for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and their subsidized loans to people for mortgages? What I mean is, could there be a time where we would see a lot of defaults on state mortgages and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation would end up owning a lot of houses with no buyers?
Certainly, if the economy busts and everybody leaves.
What drew me to that question was thinking about declining petroleum revenues. If, for instance, we see a decrease in state employment due to declining petroleum revenues, and therefore people wouldn't be able to make their mortgage payments.
Sure, clearly. It presumes that the economy of Alaska remains healthy. And it's interesting to note that if you listen to the voices on the horizon, the voice was sort of started by David Rayum when he was with state government as a principal economist, and generally he's now a private consultant. It kind of grew with other economists, including myself, who said, hey, we're looking at the short run, but we better be looking at the long run also. And now, economists like Bob Richards of Alaska Pacific Bank, who has traditionally been a very optimistic viewer of Alaska, is now saying, hey, we better start looking at what's really going to happen to Alaska in the future. And quite honestly, if we continue to artificially stimulate the economy, but petroleum revenues, which are the basis for that artificial stimulation, no longer exist, then clearly we could be in a case where the pyramid comes tumbling down, because we have no way of holding up the block. I'm not trying to say we all ought to pack up and go to Tahiti or Mexico. Mexico would be a terrible place to go right now because of their oil revenues. But I mean that we could all pick up and leave. But I think we also have to realize that we got a very healthy appetite for a lot of things, material sense, and that perhaps we are not going to be able to maintain that level of expectations into the future.
Now, it seems that one rationale behind this artificial stimulation, behind the loan program, has been to try and encourage a private economy develop. In the case where petroleum revenues sufficiently decline that our pyramid begins to crumble a little bit, do you think we'll have enough of a strong private economy to cushion the blow?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that the government sector of the Alaska economy is about 2.5 times bigger than the government sector of the nation as a whole. We are 2.5 times more dependent upon government employment in Alaska than the nation as a whole. The government sector is really the source of employment. It's certainly not the petroleum sector, because it's a capital-intensive industry. We just don't have a lot of labor-intensive sectors, except for government. So everybody works for government. And if you look around, including myself, if you look around, everyone knows everyone seems to work for government. Now, it was going to require petroleum revenues to pay all the salaries of all those government people. And clearly, the salaries of those government people go out into the marketplace and maintain the service industries and the trade industries, such as the grocery stores and the drug stores and the fast food operations and so forth. So they are really clearly dependent also on government employment. And government employment has grown like Topsy as petroleum revenues have grown. It's interesting also to note that it isn't state government that's grown so rapidly in terms of employment. It's local government, because the state has funneled enormous sums of money to local governments, and so local governments have hired people to do all those activities. Now, as to whether we'll be able to maintain that level, I don't know. Now, as far as whether other industries can supplant petroleum, first of all, we have to realize that right now we have no other industries to supplant petroleum. Possibly the fishing and timber industry. The timber industry is in significant decline. The fishing industry is coming back from a combination of low price year and botulism. We also have very few taxes on other sectors of the economy. We have no severance taxes on any of the mineral. We have no property taxes statewide except on the oil and gas industry. We have no royalty on any of the other industries of the state. We have a 1/8 royalty share for the petroleum industry. Now, if we already don't tax these industries, and they still are not booming, then what is to presume that when petroleum revenues are in decline, we can suddenly go out and tax these industries and get the revenues to replace petroleum? After we eliminated the personal income tax, for example, we only dropped about $200 million from the program. The personal income tax, which I incidentally thought was a very good idea and still think it's a good idea, I think it was very foolish to eliminate it, really will not supplant petroleum revenues, because we're talking about revenues in the magnitudes of billions. And if we're going to tax other industries, we're talking about magnitudes in the hundreds of millions. So there is clearly no way that other industries. And I think I'm very much in favor of other industries. I think it would be wonderful, for example, to have a healthy agricultural economy in the state, because I think that to the degree that we can be self-sufficient in agricultural products, I think it's very healthy for our state. In fact, if we were an independent nation right now, we would be self-sufficient in agriculture, because we would have to be. That's why the Scandinavian countries are close to self-sufficient in agriculture, even though they're at the same latitudes that we are.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very important to have a healthy fishing industry in the state. I think it's important to have a healthy timber industry in the state. I think it's important to have hard rock mining in the state. I think the more we can get this and the more the state can encourage this, fine. But it's not going to supplant petroleum.
So the state's trying to use, many loan programs are designed to try and encourage these industries to become well-established.
Presumably.
But we're not, we can't be certain that they're going to succeed.
No, and they're so caught up in politics. I happen to be familiar with agriculture because my husband's been working in the field. And it is so wrought up in political turmoil that you can't make any rational economic decisions about it. The same for the fishing industry. We're so wrought up in the political turmoil of resident versus non-resident, big versus small, and gear restrictions, that we can't make any rational economic decisions about where we want a fishing industry to go. Maybe what we need is 4 big factory ships employing 1/10 the number of people we have now, or 1/100th, and we could produce as many fish as we do now. But we won't seem to look at anything in the state on an economic basis. We get all torn up in the political turmoil, and we can't make any rational decisions about the future. So we sort of lump along from crisis to crisis, and from crisis point to crisis point, without ever sitting down and saying, what do we really want to do? And of course, that's the political process, and you know a lot more about it than I do, because you know, you're interested in the political process. But it rots a nightmare for any rational economic decisions, because everybody's got to have their share.
And this is, over time, between now and the end of this decade, would you say that the chief pressure that we'll be building on the legislature is to say, what will we do, what will become of us economically as petroleum revenues decline? Not just in terms of state spending, but also in terms of the state as a whole, of our economy as a whole. Could we see a situation where we might be like we were right after statehood in the beginning of the 60s, where the state faced a kind of hand-to-mouth existence and had very few taxes for
its revenue? Well, clearly, if Prudhoe declines, since the probability is that 1 out of every 2 barrels of oil is going to be found in Alaska, we're not going to go back to the economic levels that we were in 1960. However, we have to also realize that many of those barrels of oil may be found on the OCS, out of continental shelf, And if they're found beyond 3 miles mean high tide, the state of Alaska does not receive any revenues. It's all federal revenue. But clearly, there's going to be more oil found in the state. There's going to be economic development in the state. And we're not going to be at the position we were in 1960. But you also have to realize we've got a heck of a lot more people in the state today than we do. So even if the pie is bigger, the number of mouths are so much bigger that the proportional share could be such that we may not be, I don't know. You know, it's like whether we should be optimistic or pessimistic. I do know that Prudhoe Bay is going to decline. I know for a fact that it's going to do that because all the laws of science tell me that when it's gone, it's gone. However, whether or not it's going to be replaced by another Prudhoe Bay, I'm not a geologist. But if we aren't, then we have some clear long-term problems, and that is we will not have petroleum revenues.
As the revenues decline, the legislature will face decisions on where to cut.
That's correct.
Given the importance of loan programs to the Alaska economy now, do you think that they will have to look at loan programs in terms of cutting loan programs, or should they look also at general government spending, the capital project spending, the other kinds of spending? In other words, if you had to make your cuts based on those declining revenues, would you try and stay away from cutting loan programs as much as possible, or would you try and cut evenly?
Well, one would presume that the loan programs, for the most part, are all created by legislative action. And therefore, statutes are on the books that have created these loan programs. And one would presume that these loan programs will become, in a true revolving sense, maintained forever and ever. So unless you want to steal them, that is, they take the money back that is already out in loanable funds, there's not much you can really do for those programs that are already in the books, unless you want to call in all the loans. Do you follow me?
Yes.
You just don't have to fund anymore, which means that over time with inflation that the real value of those loanable funds falls.
Money will keep being repaid back into them, and you can just rely on that money and not increase any
That's
more
right.
appropriations to it. Okay. Thanks a lot, Monica.
Okay.
Very interesting. This has been Alaskan Legislative Review. Tonight we've been discussing Alaska State Loan Programs with Monica Thomas, Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Alaskan Legislative Review is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm your host, Scott Sterling. Our executive producer is Carla Tanella. If you would like a cassette copy of tonight's program, please write to KUAC-FM, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99701.